Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Burning down the house here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Our guest today is Professor Wilfred Wang, who's an architect in practice in Berlin. He also is a teacher. He has taught at ETH Zurich. He has been a professor at Harvard Design School and is now professor of architecture at University of Texas, Austin. Herzlich willkommen, Professor.
Vielen Dank. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And that's the limit of my German. I'm so glad to have met you a few weeks ago in New York at that event at the German Consulate, sponsored by the Deutsches Forschungsgemeinschaft. I love saying that. It just flows so nicely. You were in a panel discussion, and you brought up that thorny issue that no one wants to seem to touch, which is quality. So in no particular order, I do want to talk at some length about quality, because I know from having done a little bit of research on your work through the wonder of the internet, on qualitative aspects instead of formalistic aspects of architecture. Something that you mentioned in that panel discussion in passing, the notion that quality of a living space should be a basic human right, which, as I understand from speaking with some of my colleagues who are more knowledgeable than I, has been studied at some length by the Finns.
Correct, yes.
Also... what is especially dear to me, which is that I feel that architecture is at a crisis point, and that if we as architects are going to have, shall have any relevance whatsoever going forward, that we need to focus more on how the architecture improves the living experience of the people who use our buildings, rather than focus in a sort of runway fashion sense of what it looks like, which we've discussed ad nauseum in previous episodes, so I don't want to get into that too much, but I really want to learn from you and to share with our listeners all over the world what you have learned and what you believe about quality and how to qualify quality, as you pointed out in a lecture that you gave at the University of Navarro, I believe it was in March of this year, which I found on YouTube, which was fascinating, really.
Interesting.
Architects and engineers are very good at quantifying aspects of sustainability, how green something is, but when it comes to criticism, which eventually devolves to I like this or I don't like it, it would be good to be able to qualify quality. So let's have our first little musical break then. Thank you.
Okay.
We're back. Burning down the house. No, thank you. Our production is... qualities are always a little bit stochastic here, but we roll with it. It's like being in an architect's studio. Chaos is always present and much appreciated. So, there's so much to talk about. Quality, metaphysics of quality, quality in architecture. Should we... is it morally defensible to even criticize one of our colleagues or friends' works of architecture? I mean, this is rich stuff. I don't know where to begin, but let's start with the Finnish experience, if we could.
Yeah, I think the unique position of the Finnish government some years ago was to enshrine in law the right to a good environment of every citizen of Finland. And I think that the consequences of this policy, which has its foundations in the education of not just students of architecture, but beginning much earlier at the level of early school kids, even specifying exactly what kind of architectural competitions should be run for public buildings in Finland, thereby ensuring that at least there is a choice to be made on the basis of design quality rather than on what happens in many other countries these days on the basis of what a building costs.
Yeah.
So all those things, I think, are very courageous, though the results, when one looks at it from a perspective of maybe over a decade and a half now, not as encouraging as one would wish, but at least there was a political will at the time, and they enacted this particular law.
How long ago did this happen, this law?
This was in the early 90s that it was passed.
Wow. Gosh, I feel like I've been living in a cave. I was not aware of that. Has anything of a similar nature been enacted in any other country of which you're
not
aware?
Not to my knowledge, no. In fact, I would say that in most countries there's been a kind of a regression away from the idea that you would select buildings for public purposes on the basis of some open competition to competitions where people... so-called star architects are invited, and then, in other words, you would have a limited competition, and then you would look at it from the perspective of which is the most spectacular design. That's at one level of selection. The other level of selection, which is a lot more depressing, is when you have a contractor or a developer enter together with an architect. That would be then based on how much a building costs.
Yeah, which is the lowest denominator of any sort of quality other than the quality of basic life safety compliance and very basic access to light or air quality or heat or cooling or...
Yeah, there would be those issues, but I think most... I mean, as experience has shown over the last decade or so, we know that even when contractors are placing a bid, normally what happens afterwards, if the cheapest offer gets commission, there are a string of additional charges which then are made in the course of the contract. And so, you think you've bought the cheapest product, but in the end, given the legal savvy of the contractor, the final budget overruns the original figure. So all of these things have to be taken with a huge pinch of salt. And they're not really worth the basis upon which they're decided. And therefore, you know, the thing that one can see, at least experienced judges of architectural designs and competition should be able to see if a concept and a design are worth anything at all.
That, however, becomes a matter of taste.
Not just a matter of taste. It's also a matter of whether there is such a thing, the most basic test that one makes as an architectural critic is, does the idea make sense in the first place with regard to the brief that was given to the competitors?
Sure.
And then, if the idea or the concept is appropriate, how was that concept translated into a design? And is there a kind of a one-to-one relationship, or are there huge discrepancies that ought to be pointed out?
Yes, and that is not always a healthy dynamic. I would give an example from my own practice. I myself, I know all sorts of things about you, but you don't know anything about me other than perhaps what you've seen on our Heritage Radio Network website. I am an architect who is, to a certain degree, a quality manager in a fairly young practice, and we were invited into a competition, a limited competition, with Starkitects. We're not particularly Starkitects yet. The brief, the site was rather small. It was constrained. It was an urban space. There was a requirement for an inordinate number of automobiles to be parked, something like 1,600 automobiles on a site that was 3 acres or something like that. So, a building with trading floors and administrative spaces for about 3,000 people. And so, as a sort of in-office charrette, we all sat together and we said, well, we could give them a very pretty tower sitting on a podium of an enormous parking structure, but we don't want to do that. It doesn't make sense. And there's a second part of the site just across this 4 lanes of traffic that they think that they'd like to turn into a campus. So let's bridge over the street with a horizontal skyscraper sort of thing. And it was the right response to the givens, but and it could have been a very nice building, but we didn't win the competition because they wanted an iconic Starkitect tower that didn't work in terms of urbanism or sustainability. And we can talk about what does that mean, sustainability, because it's a piece of the thing that we can quantify in terms of conversations about quality. And so sadly, one of the reasons that we have this particular radio forum is to try to educate those who would listen what we're trying to accomplish as architects and how we're trying to raise the quality of life on the planet. And I know that you endorse that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's take another little break. Reframe our thoughts. We'll be right back. Burning Down the House with Wilfred Wang. Do you prefer Wang, Vong, or Wong?
Wang is fine.
All right, thank you. I only ask because my father's father was Norwegian, and his name was W-A-N-G, which means something totally different in Norwegian.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, and they pronounced it Vong.
Yes.
And then my father got tired of being mistaken for being, no offense,
Chinese,
yes, and changed it to Wayne. And we're happy with that.
Right.
I want to ask you about how you define quality, then.
Yes, let me talk about that. First of all, there should be an integrity between an idea and its design, and the reality of that design. So there are three levels, if you like. So you have the concept behind the building, whether, say, for a museum, it should be a spiral form, as in the Guggenheim, whether that makes sense in terms of visiting an exhibition or not, and then how that spiral is actually realized, in this case of the Guggenheim, as a concrete structure with very fine profiles, and how that then is sensed by the visitor in terms of the materiality, the colors, the atmosphere.
Yeah,
that's kind of an inherent level at the level of the design.
I'm glad.
But there are more things than that.
Yes.
There is obviously also the relationship of the building to its physical context, its immediate surrounding, and also to its general context, that is, its culture. And in that sense, a building can make a contribution, a positive contribution, to its immediate and wider contexts. And if it does that, it has, what I would say, it makes a positive contribution to its context. It therefore has a positive set of qualities. And those are just two levels at which you can judge a piece of architecture. Once within the sense of an idea, its design, and its physical manifestation, and at the level of its physical context and its cultural context.
Yes, and that is, from my experience, totally at variance with what is reported in most of the architectural press, which only looks at idea, if any, and design. Well, the externalities of its manifestation.
Right.
But since the late 1970s or so, I think the whole idea of contextual appreciations or apprehensions or perceptions, and certainly cultural associations are, I think as a overreaction against Anglo-European postmodernism, strictly forbidden right now.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Right.
Anything that's referential to culture is seen as postmodern and therefore debased.
Right.
Which I'm not sure that I'm buying.
Well, I think that there are a couple of other forces behind this. There's a tradition that goes back at least 250 years, 300 years, to the notion that somehow a building should be a monument. It should be a symbol that is as visually striking as possible. So that in the designs by the French revolutionary architect, Étienne-Louis Boulay,
yes,
who did these huge objects that were never realized, cenotaph for
Newton.
For Newton,
yes,
which was this huge sphere made out of masonry, other things like that, that have had an influence on the design of architecture as these mute objects, these monolithic pieces, these geometrically smooth pieces that you would find across Europe and the United States throughout the 90s and the early part of this 21st century.
Yes.
that describes, in a way, an idea behind trying to recover the lost aura of architecture. That's to say, architecture should once again be a powerful symbol, should create a kind of a powerful signal in itself, despite the context, despite anything that is both culturally and physically surrounding it.
Yes, and when you first spoke of this, I was immediately thinking of Lord Burlington's Palladian Pavilion at Chiswick,
right,
which sits in a park with right. no context,
right,
other than its own one might argue perfect geometry.
Right,
a perfect monument to an idea, with no
right.
with no no urbanity,
right?
Yeah, and no context, and in the late 20th century, early 21st century, yet we see myriad works from starchitects that pretend that they're in a desert.
Right. Well, see, this tradition, if you look at modern architecture, by Mies van der Rohe, for instance, the Seagram building, this is a very serene object on New York's Park Avenue. And then you make a big jump to, say, I.M. Pei's glass pyramid in front of the Louvre, or you make another jump to OMA's concert hall in the Portuguese city of Porto, which is this kind of meteorite that has struck at the heart of the city. All these objects, in a way, are trying to be as monolithic as possible, that's to say, with as few materials as possible, in order to maximize their physical presence. And it's a form of absorption of people's attention that has parallels in the art world in the 60s and 70s, when minimalism was a big thing, and people that were in the United States, especially the artists at that time, Carl André and colleagues, were doing exactly the same for the art objects, for their sculptures, as architects were trying to do throughout the second half of this 20th century.
I know full well those people because I studied under them.
Right.
I was at Cooper and Hedick and his buddies.
Yes.
Gwathmi and Eisenman wanted
right.
to strip away all context.
Right.
All site referential and all, as Eisenman would say, acculturated responses
right.
to the past.
Right. So what you find is that is an interesting phenomenon in the world of art and world of architecture, which really is to do with these egomaniacal individuals who are sort of cultivating a form of autism. Architecture, yes, architecture is really autistic. It's a world unto itself and damn the rest.
You know that you're being provocative, of course.
Well, I'm not. I'm being absolutely serious. This is. I would defend this thesis in public, anywhere, your choice. I'm quite happy, and I've criticized the architecture of Peter Zumthor, who has, in a way, in the same footsteps as individuals like Donald Judd.
Sure.
Insisted that architecture and pieces of furniture should be as simple as possible. And in the case of Donald Judd's sofa, for instance, or his bed,
yeah.
that's not a problem because you have an intervening mattress. But if you sit in that chair that he designed with a horizontal seating surface and a vertical backrest, it's one of the most uncomfortable objects that you can imagine.
Well, it's not for sitting in. It's the idea that you might sit.
Yes.
And then... And
well,
then,
exactly.
Yes.
But, you know, what you had 50 years earlier with architects like Oud, the Dutch mm-hmm. Modern architect, he designed for the Weissenhof settlement in Germany a chair made out of tubular steel that had a vertical backrest and a horizontal square horizontal seat surface. Completely uncomfortable, and yet he fundamentally believed that that was the essence of a chair. It probably is the essence of a chair, but for heaven's sake, you know, we are not geometric objects.
I don't want... You have probably not listened to many of the episodes of this particular program, but there is a certain puckish nature to discourse here, and I just have to say that perhaps Aoud was an adherent to the ancient Chinese notion of qigong, in which case you should be sitting absolutely as if your head was suspended by a thread.
Right.
And but most of us are not that evolved. And the American furniture designer, Niels Diffrient, believes that we should slouch. And that's the basis of ergonomics. That you should recline, which then, if you roll it back, the Romans only ate inclined in their tricliniums.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, and
if I were on television now, you would see me reclining in my chair.
And as well you should. Let us take another little break and get back to our conversation. Carlos?
Yes.
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking to my engineer.
Okay.
Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne talking about quality with Professor Wilfred Wang. Are you still there?
I am.
Very well. That was from Richard Strauss, because when I think about how there's a disconnect between what people like and what people want, then I think about the Wiener Werkstätte, which was a Gesamtkunstwerk sort of idea of integrating decorative things into the architectural environment. What's your take on that?
Well, that was a very important movement, of course, and it's a sign of the really sophisticated discourse that was led in Vienna during the intervening period between the First and Second World War, that you would have an enormously heated debate between the people who were trying to propagate the kind, the tradition of the Wiener Werkstätte, which, as you say, is a highly crafted, highly designed kind of tradition, vis-a-vis people who were a lot more critical of that at the most extreme end, Adolf Loos.
Yeah.
And furthermore, another critic, Josef Frank. I don't know whether you've ever come across that person's name.
I have not. Tell me more.
Josef Frank was a Viennese architect, a contemporary of Adolf Loos, and I would say he was even more radical in his cultural and architectural critique than Loos. What he was saying, for instance, was that if you looked at the tubular steel chair that Mies van der Rohe designed, called the so-called Freischwinger, the one where you have the semicircular legs at the front,
mm-hmm.
Made out of tubular steel and woven or leather seat upholstery.
But wasn't that later?
That was later, but that was in the 30s. I'm just saying that...
That would be an example.
Yeah. Josef Frank would attack that kind of modernist design.
Yes.
By saying, if you look at that chair and you compare it to the traditional chair with its four legs, the kind of tubular part of the semicircular legs are not really necessary for the structure of the chair.
No,
it's
of course not.
Decoration.
Yes.
And to use the word decoration in the 30s was like the worst kind of criticism you could make of a functionalist position.
Absolute anathema.
Right. So just using that as an example of the position of somebody like Josef Frank vis-a-vis the modernists. Now, Adolf Loos would have a similar kind of critical position vis-a-vis the Wiener Werkstätte, whose one of leading figures was Josef Hoffmann.
Yes.
And they were pretty much lifelong enemies. You probably know of the story when there was an exhibition of the results of the masterclass of Josef Hoffmann's students, where they were showing off the different saddles that the students had designed. And Adolf Loos wrote an essay saying, if only I had so little knowledge of leather, horse riding, and posture, as obviously the students and their professor, I could also be as imaginative as they are.
Well,
in other words, it's all very well.
But wait.
It's all very well coming up with all these interesting ornamental designs and so on of the Wiener Werkstätte. But fundamentally, Adolf Loos was saying there are all these traditions to which we can and should adhere, and that we should actually try and develop those things rather than imagine that we have all these liberties come up with these new forms. So he was the extreme conservative.
Well, Wilfred, I now find myself at cross purposes in having a comity with you.
Yes.
Because on the one hand, I, to use American slang, hang with people who highly favor biomimicry. In truth, and they can hate me for having said this. They have no idea where it goes, but they think that it goes someplace good.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, this quotation that you've just given exactly describes my discontents with recent graduates of architecture school who have no understanding whatsoever of the realities of building the merest shelter.
Right.
Because they have been inculcated with the formalistic possibilities of computer generated
software. Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right.
And CAD, computer aided design.
Mm.
Increasingly, in my experience as a practitioner, is often as useful as using a bulldozer to rearrange the furniture in your living room.
Right.
So, on one hand, I would love to see an integration of, on a social level, I would love to see an integration or a forum for us architects to be able to know sculptors and painters and weavers and furniture makers and leather people, because I think it would enrich the experience of the totality of the received environment, you know, that populates the world that we live in with architects as a guiding light.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I see that our young architects are totally unprepared to even address the merest of keeping the rain from coming in when they design wacky stuff.
Well, I mean, the rain is one thing. You know, we talked about issues of quality and what might actually constitute a significant contribution to an immediate physical context and the more general cultural context. And I would say that architectural design, in the end, if it is to be successful, it is a form of cultural criticism. That means that you have to be aware of the larger context in which you're working, whether it's economical in terms of contract law, in terms of costs, in terms of the kinds of values that people aspire to, the forms of behavior, etc., before you can set out to make a significant architectural design. And that's why I think that if people believe that all they really need is certain kinds of sophisticated software to generate forms, and maybe as weird as and wonderful as possible forms, they're completely barking up the wrong tree, because if they neglect the study of the cultural context, they will always just develop forms for the sake of forms, what one calls formalism.
I adore your trope, weird as possible.
Well, it is. I mean,
well,
that's what you see, right?
Yes.
You look at the architectural journals, and that is what they put out. So, you know, the question that one might raise is that are architects ahead of the curve? Are they always condemned to be the avant-gardists who are misunderstood? Or should we try to design things that are actually understood by as large an audience as possible? And I'm not playing the kind of populist card. I'm saying architecture by its nature can be didactic when it's constructed.
Yes.
Or when it's designed. You know, you can look at it if you provide lay audience or a set of architectural critics with sufficient information before a building is constructed, they can look at it and they can understand it. So a judgment can be passed on a design. But setting that aside, if a building is actually constructed, if it's if it can be visited and observed and seen in reality, most people understand the resultant quality. Whether they use different kinds of ways of reading, that's another issue. But they can understand, you know, is there a clear sign of a main entrance? Can I find my way around this building? What kind of atmosphere does it have? And most people are able to read atmospheres quite well without having to have any form of education in architecture.
And at that point, Wilfred, I think we need to take another break and get back to you in about 3 minutes.
Good.
Thank you. We're back with Wilfred Wang, professor of architecture at UT Austin. We're talking about perception. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm still here.
Yeah. All right, then. You were lost in the music, perhaps?
No.
All right. Okay. I don't know if you get music when you're listening.
I do, yes. I can hear that.
All right.
Yes.
That was Prokofiev.
Yes.
It was... I was raised on Prokofiev. My mother
gloomy.
Was.
Gloomy rather than the somewhat jumpy and gay form of Viennese, late Viennese music of Richard Strauss.
Well, you know, that's very interesting. I mean, here's the format of my program. We can talk about anything we want to talk about because everything matters in terms of architecture. Every conversation that we have between us as architects informs and directs what we do next. So if I say, well, then Prokofiev was always a joyful thing for me, then you can say, well, you found it gloomy.
In contrast to the piece by Richard Strauss. That's what I'm saying. It's a kind of a, rather than on its own. I think that there are obviously some forms of syncopations in that music which were rather than not gloomy, but the overall contrast between the two pieces, I would say, it's a little bit more gloomy.
Compared with what the
Richard Strauss.
Yes, Richard Strauss, the Rosenkavalier.
Yes, Rosenkavalier.
Yes, well, I was raised with both, and so I suppose that means I'm musically bipolar.
No, not at all. I mean, I listen to Prokofiev and Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff and all those people, as well as Richard Strauss and Gustav Mahler. And
yes, of course.
So, you know, of course, Gustav Mahler is a lot more gloomy in many, many parts.
I have a problem with Mahler. Can I ask you a personal question?
Please.
Your family name is Wang.
Yes.
But you were born in Hamburg.
Yes.
So you are ostensibly ethnically Chinese, but you are purely German.
Yes, I was brought up in Germany with German culture. I went to school in England, I studied in London, and then I started working in the United States. So I've traveled and lived in different parts of the world.
So you consider yourself...
I consider myself as a world citizen with
a
German passport and a U.S. green card.
you're one up on me, man. I just have a U.S. passport. I don't have any sort of EU. I can't work in Europe without machinations.
Right.
Yes, well, you don't want to talk about your father. Okay, that's fine.
No, I am happy to talk about my father. He was, my parents are were Chinese, or are Chinese, and my father was a scholar to start off with. He was the director of a Chinese school in the Philippines and an editor of a Chinese newspaper. Went underground during the Japanese occupation, left the Philippines after the Second World War to become a commodity trader, working in San Francisco, met my mother on a business trip, and then decided to move to Germany, to Hamburg, because he wanted to set up on his own. So that's the story of my father.
Well, there you go. Well, that is very much like an American life.
Absolutely.
Yes. You know, welcome to America.
Thank you.
You're like me. I have a very varied and deep... Anyway, what I wanted to talk about next was perception. You spoke about you're having... comment on the football stadium at Braga with your good friend Eduardo.
Yes.
Yes. And that really therein is a twofold thing. One, from your point of view, and I extrapolate, it's not good architecture because the footballers and the people observing the football, they don't get the thrill of the goal.
Right.
On the other hand, the Pritzker family and their anointed...
jury members.
Yeah. Gave the equivalent of a Nobel Prize to your friend, which I don't doubt that he deserves, but as you said, it's a very good work in architecture, but I don't think it's a very good football stadium.
Right.
I don't want to put you on the point, but...
I don't mind talking about it. I talked to Eduardo prior to the completion of the design of this soccer field, the football stadium in Braga in the north of Portugal.
Yes.
Saying that this is a very interesting structure, but it's not going to be the right kind of atmosphere for a soccer stadium, because in a soccer stadium you really need to have the atmospheric pressure. It's like a pressure cooker that needs to engender the mood of excitement and of community. And by leaving the two ends of the stadium completely without any stands, without any seating facilities, one looking towards the old quarry and the other looking towards the city of Braga, it dissipates energy completely. And I think that it's an interesting concrete structure, but it's not a good football stadium.
Yes.
And so Eduardo knows my position on this. I think that you don't need to have all of your buildings being masterpieces in order to be worthy of the Pritzker Prize. I fully wish him well on being the recipient of the Pritzker. But that building was not a good soccer stadium.
And yet, that is an image that is frequently thrown up as how you win a Pritzker Prize. Which,
absolutely.
Yeah, which suggests that the jurors of the Pritzker Prize favor a modernist, shall we say, constructivist paradigm.
Well, I think you're right. I'd never thought about it like that. I suppose Robert Venturi and Jim Sterling were the early ones who were sort of not falling into that category. Yes,
yes. Yes. I mean, the aggressive geometry suggests that the people that the Pritzkers choose for their juries highly favor, to go back to a previous trope of things that I have discussed previously here on Heritage Radio Network, form over function.
Well, you could say that, although I would say that at least the single-family houses that Eduardo designed are some of the finest pieces of domestic architecture that you can find in the late 20th century, early 21st century.
Well, that's good.
And it's interesting that Lord Palumbo, who has owned some Mies buildings, that he should find those particularly wholesome.
Yes, well, in the late 21st century, we'll find probably that Mies was entirely unwholesome because he favored form over the merest ability to crack a window in, say, the Farnsworth house.
Right.
Right. And so I think that... well, I truly believe that you and I actually share a common goal. You in the academic sphere and I, one by one, with my mentees as I work as a quality manager, try to inculcate the notion of you must... this is why I brought back the notion of Gesamtkunstwerk. I have the notion, perhaps I am fallacious in this notion, that the Wiener Werkstätte considered all aspects of creation.
Well, I mean, I agree with the notion of Gesamtkunstwerk, total work of art.
Yes.
The question is whether every time you need to reinvent the wheel. And I would share in the position of Adolf Loos and Josef Frank to some extent of their criticism of the Wiener Werkstätte insofar as we don't need to produce a new desk, a new cupboard, wardrobe, whatever, what have you, or door handle every time we design a house. So, or a building, and therefore the question is, what is, where do we need to focus our creative energies in order to improve the world in which we live? And I think that there are very fundamental issues. We haven't really talked about sustainability.
No, we haven't.
There are very fundamental issues in the design field that we should focus our energies on, and not to waste our time and energy on the design of some small door handle, which for a door handle manufacturer, just because he wants to have a star architect, a star name design a door handle.
Yes, I totally agree. I mean, here's the thing. We could go for another hour talking about the issues that we brought up that we have not talked about. And, yeah.
Well, I'd be happy to come back.
I'm so happy to hear that.
What we haven't talked about is the issue, for instance, that concerns me greatly, that is the repeated dominance of technology and quantification in the world of creation, where in architecture we are submitting to things, stupid things like the LEED system, where we're not really allowing ourselves the role that we really have as quality managers. That's the word you use. I use the word of what the purpose of an architect is altogether. That is to be a kind of a conductor of different skill sets, to bring those things together in order to make sure that they're all integrated.
Well, let me just defend my role as quality manager. In the role that I have beneficently been given, I inculcate in my young mentees all of the things that you've just said. And I hope that our studio will become a legendary studio. I tell them that we have the possibility to be a studio like not so much Wright and his mentees, but more like pick one. Not Alvar. No.
Alvar Aalto?
Not Alvar Aalto, but more at Saarinen. Right. Aero Saarinen, where anything was possible, and form also had function.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might argue that Aero was more on form and not on function, and I would agree with you. And things have changed, but that's a great place to depart from,
mm-hmm.
and also integrate context, because Aero Saarinen, maybe not so much as Eliel Saarinen, his father, was a cultural and also a anti-contextual. And I would love to integrate both context, culture, praktik. I mean that in terms of the higher form of construction.
Right.
To get back to Vitruvius, commodity, fermenty and delight, Venustas. I think that we as architects have not been doing our job in terms of delight. I hope that we can talk about that at further. I won't hold you over. I hope that you will come back and talk with us again. Carlos, let's go to the last track and roll with it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All the best. Bye.
Thank you very much. This has been Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We've been talking about quality and a lot of different things with Wilfried Wang. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith. Wilfried, if you're on still, you can put in your own bit. No. Roll it. Rock it.
That ain't working. That's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Now that ain't working. That's the way you do it. Let me tell you, damn guy.